long-standing critique of school segregation, of housing segregation, of job discrimination. King sees these as national, not local. But again, we've told a story where King is in the South till 1965, and somehow then, when Watts erupts, then he discovers the North, when in fact Dr. King had been in LA more than 15 times before the Watts uprising, had been protesting around police brutality for years, joined a movement in 1962 protesting the police killing of Nation of Islam Secretary Ron Stokes, had talked about, this is King, no compromise on this issue, in LA in 1962. In 1963, calling LA as segregated as Birmingham, even while he's engaged in the movement in Birmingham. But we tend to see that as a Southern story when King is talking about everywhere.
And that's right. You titled the book King of the North. We're going to talk more about it at democracynow.org. Jean Theo Harris, historian, new book, King of the North, Martin Luther King Jr.'s Life of Struggle Outside the South. That does it for our show. Happy birthday to Mike DeFilippo. Coming up Memorial Day, our special, we speak to acclaimed filmmaker Ryan Coogler about his new film, Sinners, and to Keith Lamar on death row in Ohio. Look for our new job listings. We're hiring a senior headline news producer, director of audience, director of technology. Go to democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
This is Ursula K. Le Guin, and you are listening to KBOO, the cheerful voice of social conscience. KBOO, Portland.
Support for KBOO comes from KBOO members and Grendel's Coffee Shop, located at East Burnside and 8th Avenue in Portland, featuring coffee, tea, sandwiches, and more. Information at grendelspdx.com.
Join KBOO around the campfire. Become a member during Camp KBOO's Summer Drive, taking place now through June 29th. Your contribution goes towards grassroots community radio. Donate now by going to kboo.fm/give. Thank you.
Support for KBOO comes from its members and from the Jewish-Palestinian Alliance of Oregon, presenting a benefit concert for the people of Gaza on Friday, May 30th at the First Unitarian Church. All proceeds will support the Palestine Children's Relief Fund, which provides medical care to children from Palestine as well as direct aid to Gaza. Tickets and info at jpao.org/events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Portland City Council has approved an $8.5 billion city budget.
Tina Kotek searches for a way to ban phones in schools.
And Harvard sues the Trump administration over a federal ban on admitting international students to the Ivy League school.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, May 23rd, 2025. I'm Dave Johnson.
And I'm Dejon. Portland City Council passed preliminary $8.5 billion budget after a marathon 15-hour session on Wednesday. This budget attempts to tackle a historic funding gap with shortfalls estimated at $93 million in Portland's general fund alone. The new City Council submitted over 120 amendments for consideration, but most of these were either voted down or pushed out to a future session. Less than a quarter of proposed amendments were included in the approved budget, with some generating intense political heat. In a 7-5 vote, the council succeeded in passing an amendment that would shift $1.9 million in new funding from the Portland Police Bureau to Portland's Parks and Recreation. According to OPB, Councilor Candace Avalos said, quote, "This is not about reducing police effectiveness. It is about a balanced approach to public safety that includes well-maintained parks where families feel safe gathering," end quote. Advocates also cited a recent poll commissioned by the council showing 42% of Portlanders approve of spending cuts to police, compared to only 28% for parks and recreation. Opponents, including Council President Elena Pertolgini, reacted strongly to the proposal, stressing the city's public safety priorities and possible impact on public perceptions. Councilor Olivia Clark considered the amendment, quote, absolutely a false choice between parks and police.
Other amendments that the council approved included measures to increase revenue and cut costs. Fees on rideshare services would increase from 65 cents to $2 per ride, and public golf courses would see another $5 in fees. Each councilor's individual budgets would be reduced by $120,000, and bureau leadership salaries and classifications would be reevaluated. Many amendments did not pass a vote, reflecting the different areas of city involvement at play. The failed proposals included additional funds for the city's new police oversight board, the closure of Multnomah Arts Center and Community Music Center, and a plan to hold back $13 million from the city's economic development program, Prosper Portland. This is the first city budget in the transition to a new governance structure. And expanded city council mandated by the revised city's charter. State law requires city officials to now submit the council's preliminary budget approval to the Tax Supervising and Conservation Commission for review. The city council has scheduled another session June 11th for vote on dozens of future amendments. The council will vote on formal adoption June 18th, making the budget legally binding. KABU reporter Dejon has asked Portlanders what they think about the Portland budget.
Portland is facing a budget shortfall. On Wednesday, the Portland City Council approved an amendment to the mayor's budget proposal to shift $2 million from the police department to support parks maintenance. The mayor, Keith Wilson, proposed a budget earlier this month that would increase funding for police, fire, and street response by nearly $20 million, while also cutting funding to departments like parks and permitting. The mayor also wants to hire more police officers to mitigate the cost of overtime. This is what some folks in Portland had to say about the shaky budget and the mayor's push to hire more police officers.
The budget cuts are definitely, it does suck because there are a lot of people in need, children in need of parks, safe parks, places to be that are clean and healthy for them, but more police. I mean, if they're good people, you know, because I feel like all the police, they just have this complex of I'm a god, like I'm above you, I can do what I want. And there's a lot of police that get away with a lot of stuff because they're in power. And there are women that have been abused, colored women that have been abused by police because they can get away with it. That one's a tough one.
Absolutely not. We literally have enough apartments in the city to house every single homeless person and then some. Like, a lot of people end up in, like, harm's way, too, like, during, like, police investigations, shakedowns and stuff. I think it's definitely more important to just, like, give people, you know, what they need.
It is good to have more police because it is a big city, so you're going to need more coverage because, obviously, if you have a small unit or not enough, then you're not going to be able to get to all the crime in the city. But also, at the same time, why are you going to make this city more ran down when there's already enough police? Because I see police all over the place. Literally not one street I don't see a cop. So why are you going to deteriorate this city even more than it already is?
I think it depends on who those officers are, just because I think if it's like meant to help a community that may be like over-policed in the past, or a community that's like underfunded, I think sometimes more police officers that understand their issues could be helpful. However, I think that if you're just like hiring officers that don't necessarily like understand what the people in a specific community are going through, I think it could cause more harm than good. So I would just need more information before I can make like a really strong position on that.
If they're going to increase or keep their spending the same, I think it needs to be funneled more directly to solving some of the issues within the police department. Not necessarily hiring more individuals, but maybe fixing the things that the individuals we have can't seem to take care of.
That was some folks in Portland giving their opinions about the shaky budget and Mayor Keith Wilson's budget proposal earlier this month. For KBOO News, I'm Dejan. Students are experiencing not only rising costs of tuition, but other costs associated with attending college as well. Expenses like housing, food, and textbooks are starting to become a barrier for most. Students have had to face tough choices like dropping out and taking on a second job to afford rent or live in their car until they complete their degree. College Housing Northwest is a nonprofit that runs the Affordable Rent for College Students program. The program gives students a fighting chance at crossing the finish line by providing subsidized housing for college students. However, the need for affordable student housing far outweighs the nonprofit's capacity, which is why college students and student basic needs advocates are pushing for their third time to get Oregon lawmakers to adopt a package of bills that will provide students with the basic needs they require to graduate. Oregon officials have projected that 300,000 new jobs would require a degree, certificate, or some other type of credential. But according to a report by the HECC, the state is behind and is projected to only award 200,000 credentials by the end of the decade. Nick Keough is an Oregon legislative analyst with the American Federation of Teachers. Nick said, quote, "State investments are more important than ever to fill the gaps left by reduced federal support," end quote. The Student Basic Needs and Workforce Stabilization Act, which includes House Bill 3182 and House Bill 3183, both sit in the Joint Committee on Ways and Means, unclear on whether they will succeed.
Governor Kotek's office is considering an executive order after a bill that would have banned cell phones in schools died in the state legislature. House Bill 2251 would require all school districts in Oregon to bar students from using phones from the start of the regular school day until its end. The bill would require schools to set their own limits and enforce the mandate. This would put Oregon in league with at least 19 other states that bans on K through 12 phone use. A majority of the school districts had concerns about funding and student safety. The five-person Senate Education Committee held lengthy discussions on Wednesday. Senator Lou Frederick, the committee chair, argued that the bill should be sent to the state, or rather to the Senate Regulation Committee. This would allow the bill to avoid deadlines and address lingering concerns. Democratic senators were against the bill. Against moving the bill. Senator Susan Weber's concerns were how the state mandate could be costly to enforce, stating, quote, "I had one superintendent on Saturday tell me the money is tight. They're having to let people go," end quote. Others worried that the bill removed protections in current law for students with disabilities who need phones for communication or schoolwork. Governor Kotek's spokesperson, Lucas Bezerra, stated that after the meeting, quote, "Governor Kotek is very disappointed that HB 2251 did not advance. She'd been clear that the bill was a priority and hopes the bill can be brought back and that she is actively exploring executive action," end quote.
Park Lane Skate Park is now open after construction finished last week. KB reporter Lexis Ponce speaks with local skateboarders about what aspects of the newly finished park they like.
Park Lane Park reopens in southeast Portland with a new playground, splash pad, and skate park. The construction of the Park Lane Park expansion began in April 2023 and was completed in May 2025 and is now open to the public. I talked to some local skateboarders on their perspective.
What's your name?
Marco Cervantes.
Nacho Ponce.
When did you start skateboarding?
I started skating when I was 14.
I first started skateboarding when I was 12.
What are your favorite skate parks in the area?
Glen Heaven Skate Park and Burnside.
I really like Burnside and Gateway Skate Park.
What kind of features do you like to see in a skate park?
Hips, small rails, ledges, and quarter pipes.
I like bowls and quarter pipes and small rails.
How do you feel about the layout and size of this park?
Really like it. It's very flowy. You can go back and forth.
I really like it. It has a big bowl and I could go back and forth in it.
How have skate parks and skateboarding changed your life?
It changed my life because I met all my friends through skating and I get to go all over the place with my skateboard.
It's changed my life in a really awesome way. I got to meet a lot of other skateboarders that are my best friends now.
For KBOO News, I am Lexis Ponce.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after the newscast for Counterspin. At 6, it's Rising Up with Sonali. Then at 7, Once Upon a Time. Tonight's weather, look for a high of 70 degrees at roughly 6 p.m. with a low of 49. Tomorrow, Saturday, May 24th, is going to be warm and sunny with a high of 78 degrees and an overnight low of 52. Today in history, notorious American outlaws Bonnie and Clyde were killed in a police shootout near Gibbsland, Louisiana. The quote of the day is from Rebecca Solnit, American writer and activist. In her book, Looking into Darkness, she writes, quote, "To hope is to gamble. It's to bet on the future, on your desires, on the possibility that an open heart and uncertainty are better than gloom and safety. To hope is dangerous. And yet, it is the opposite of fear. For to live is to risk."
A federal judge has temporarily halted the Trump administration's ban on Harvard's ability to enroll international students just hours after Harvard filed a suit. The Ivy League University is formally challenging the administration's decision, calling it unconstitutional retaliation for defying the White House's political demands. In a lawsuit filed today in federal court in Boston, Harvard said the government's actions violates the First Amendment and will have, quote, "an immediate and devastating effect for Harvard and more than 7,000 visa holders," end quote. Things are tense on campus. Just days before graduation, international students who run labs, teach courses, assist professors, and participate in Harvard sports have to decide whether to transfer or risk losing legal status to stay in the country. The impact is greatest at graduate schools such as Harvard Kennedy School, where almost half of the student body comes from abroad, and Harvard Business School, which is around one-third international. The Trump administration accuses Harvard of creating an unsafe campus environment by allegedly allowing anti-American, pro-terrorist agitators to assault Jewish students on campus. The administration also accused Harvard of working with the Chinese Communist Party, saying the school had hosted and trained members of a Chinese paramilitary group in 2024. In early May, Harvard President Alan Garber said the university has a broad strategy to combat anti-Semitism. He added, "The school would not budge on core, legally protected principles over fears of retaliation." Harvard enrolls almost 6,800 foreign students at its campus in Cambridge, Massachusetts. They come from more than 100 countries.
The Supreme Court deadlocks, preventing the establishment of the first U.S. publicly funded religious school. Republicans are giddy over House passage of the recent domestic policy bill. And the Trump administration is suing states over climate action. With those stories and more, it's Catherine Carley with 2025 Talks.
Welcome to 2025 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times. There are charter schools in Oklahoma that focus on Native American culture, that focus on performing arts, that focus on nature as examples. And simply refusing to allow religious schools to participate in that, that's not neutral.
Kristen Wagner with the Christian advocacy group Alliance Defending Freedom says Oklahoma's ban on what would be the nation's first publicly funded religious school is unconstitutional. But a deadlocked Supreme Court has upheld that ban, which says the school would violate church-state separation. The vote was 4-4, with Justice Amy Coney Barrett recusing herself. A federal judge has blocked President Donald Trump's efforts to dismantle the Department of Education and ordered 1,000 employees reinstated. National Education Association President Becky Pringle calls it a win against the administration's goal of privatizing public schools.
Public education is the foundation of this or any democracy. We need people to pay attention.
A separate federal court will let Trump go ahead for now with firing two members of an independent labor agency. The only suspect in the shooting of two Israeli embassy employees has been charged with murder. Police are treating it as a hate crime. House Republicans are celebrating passage of their massive spending and policy bill. It includes tax cuts mainly for top earners and corporations and shifts billions from Medicaid and food assistance to national defense. Congresswoman Lisa McClain of Michigan says they delivered for the president.
House Republicans did not miss the moment. And because of our work, we will put more money in the pockets of hardworking Americans.
Two Republicans joined Democrats in opposition. The White House says Trump wants them primaried. The Justice Department is suing four states for tackling climate change. New York, Vermont, Michigan, and Hawaii enacted so-called climate superfund laws, which charge oil companies billions to help pay for climate damage. Nick Jansen with Maine Conservation Voters says his state should push ahead.
The longer we delay in setting up a program like this, the higher that bill is going to be and the more strained communities are going to be under.
Senate leaders used procedural rules to avoid a filibuster, moving to block California from enforcing a ban on new gas-powered cars in 10 years. The Supreme Court has turned away a petition by Michigan Republicans seeking to overturn voting measures approved via ballot initiative. That includes no-excuse absentee voting and expanded early voting. And the High Court is expected to take up a lawsuit to prevent states from accepting mail-in ballots that arrive after Election Day. Several GOP-led states have already passed laws ending so-called grace periods. I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
Black Democratic lawmakers are targeted by the Trump administration, according to The Intercept. Democratic Representative LaMonica McIver was charged with assault 2 weeks ago, Friday, May 9th, after a skirmish at Newark Immigration Detention Center in New Jersey. McIver was visiting the ICE Detention Facility Center with Newark Mayor Rasa Baraka and fellow Congress members Bonnie Watson Coleman and Rob Menendez. ICE agents attempted to arrest the mayor, who lacked the congressional member's clearance to be on site conducting the oversight visit. The Congress members moved to protect the mayor, encircling the man and linking arms to prevent him being handcuffed by ICE officials. The Department of Homeland Security described the incident as, quote, a bizarre political stunt, end quote, and as a break-in, saying the congressional members, quote, stormed the facility. McIver countered that her party was there on official business and that ICE agents created the situation. On Sunday, May 18th, Chicago Mayor Brandon Johnson spoke to the congregation at the Apostolic Church of God, boasting of his administration's striking diversity. The Chicago mayor described it as, quote, the most diverse administration in the history of Chicago, unquote. These comments went viral, and the White House announced its investigation the next day. The probe is based on information suggesting that the mayor, quote, made hiring decisions solely on the basis of race. Trump has made it a priority of his administration to end the practice of encouraging diversity in the workforce. DEI initiatives, or diversity, equity, and inclusion, have been described by Trump as, quote, illegal and immoral discrimination programs, end quote. DEI programs were put into place to address the unfair treatment of minorities by job providers.
Bison are being restored to tribal lands across the Mountain West and the Great Plains. With that story and more, it's Brian Bull with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull, sitting in for Antonia Gonzalez. Bison are being restored to tribal lands across the Mountain West and the Great Plains. As the Mountain West News Bureau's Rachel Cohen reports, a herd managed in Colorado is playing a big role.
A few bison jumped into a grass-lined trailer. They were heading to the Kiowa tribe in Oklahoma. The bison are part of two herds that live in mountain parks owned by the city and county of Denver. And the city gave these 10 away so the Kiowa tribe could start its first herd in over 150 years. Bison were hunted to near extinction in the 1800s. Rick Williams is Oglala Lakota in Northern Cheyenne and was at the bison transfer in March. He says it included a ceremony and a song for a safe journey.
The buffalo were a sacred animal to us. We knew that they provided all of our economy and our lifestyle and everything that we needed to survive.
Denver's donation is part of a larger effort to give surplus bison from conservation herds and national parks to tribes to restore cultural and environmental connections. Over the past 7 years, Denver has given 140 bison to 10 tribes. That includes the Northern Arapaho in Wyoming and the Northern Cheyenne in Montana. I'm Rachel Cohen.
Carol Pickett Hull was remembered at an Anchorage memorial ceremony as someone who was more than an athlete. She also worked hard to build the Native Youth Olympics into the success it is today. The Inupiaq athlete died at the age of 61 at her home in Seward on May 5th. As KNBA's Rhonda McBride tells us, friends and competitors alike say she embodied the spirit of traditional Native games.
Carol Pickett Hull was only 5'4", but became a giant in her sport when she set a new world record for the 1 foot high kick at the 1989 World Eskimo Indian Olympics. That's when she jumped with 1 foot to kick a tiny ball suspended 7 feet in the air.
Tiny little powerhouses.
That's how Nicole Johnson described herself and Carol when they met as teenagers.
There's nothing that could stop us. Our height, our weight, our ages, nothing stopped Carol from doing what she loved to do.
When she won the 1 foot high kick, she was asked if she wanted to go for the record. She had this infectious excitement. Yes.
Reggie Jewell is a 10-time gold medalist in the blanket toss. He says Carol and her teammates came along at a time when men dominated the games, but that soon changed.
They were coming onto the scene with this energy, but also with this hunger.
A hunger for the strength and spirit of their culture, which Carol tried to embody. Her 1989 record would stand at WIO until last year, when Emily King, a Canadian from Whitehorse, would surpass Carol's record by an inch. A memorable moment for Greg Nostein, a longtime competitor and game official.
Carol was out there being her biggest fan and said, "You can do it, you can do it."
Over the years, Carol Pickett Hull seemed to be an endless source of encouragement. She coached, she officiated, and became one of her sport's biggest cheerleaders. When she first entered the scene, the games were held in small gymnasiums. Today, the statewide Native Youth Olympics draws thousands of athletes and their fans, a reminder of how a little encouragement can go a long way. In Anchorage, I'm Rhonda McBride.
And on this day in 1838, the infamous forced march of thousands of Cherokees from their land began, a 1,000-mile trek towards Oklahoma that became known as the Trail of Tears. U.S. troops were armed with rifles and bayonets, and many Cherokee died from starvation, illness, or hypothermia. The estimated 25 million acres they were forced to relinquish in the southeast were taken by white settlers. You're listening to National Native News. I'm Brian Bull.
Some say fighting climate change is a personal responsibility, but research shows collective action as well as individual efforts are both important. Nadia Ramlagan joins us once again.
It will take both collective change and individual action to make headway against climate change, says a new report from the World Resources Institute. As the current administration rolls back environmental protections, it's a crucial time for both people and movements, says Lauren Onelis, founder of the nonprofit Food Empowerment Project. Around a third of global greenhouse gas emissions come from food, largely driven by the production of red meat. Ornelas says shifting diets away from meat and dairy may not solve the climate crisis alone, but eating less meat can be one empowering individual choice made stronger in large numbers.
Our food choices are powerful in what we say about ourselves. They're powerful in terms about what we say about the society in which we want to live in.
It's estimated about 6% of Americans describe themselves as vegan or vegetarian. United Nations research also suggests people eat less beef and shift to more plant-forward diets. In West Virginia, climate change is intensifying extreme weather events, from spring and winter flooding to summer and fall droughts, according to EPA data. Mindy Hernandez, report co-author and director of the Living Lab for Equitable Climate Action at the World Resources Institute, says collective action is the driving factor behind industry change.
I think that there are people out there trying to overwhelm progressives, and so our fight has to be staying grounded and staying strategic.
The research also finds that pro-climate behavior changes are enough, potentially, to theoretically cancel out all the greenhouse gas emissions an average person produces each year, specifically among high-income, high-emitting populations. This story was produced with original reporting from Jessica Scott Reed for Sentient. This is Nadia Romligon for West Virginia News Service.
Chicago Mass Transit, or public transportation, is legendary, but extreme weather events are threatening to disrupt the system. Dr. Anthony Leisowitz has more with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Leisowitz, and this is Climate Connections. To get around, hundreds of thousands of Chicagoans ride a bus or the L, the city's rapid transit system. But as climate change causes more extreme weather, some of those trips could be disrupted.
The precipitation that we're expecting to receive in the future is going to come at us in very short bursts.
That's Kate Avasic of the Chicago Metropolitan Agency for Planning. A report from her agency warns that a third of the city's L stops and over half of its bus stops are at risk of flooding. So at times, L riders may face delays and bus riders may need to wade through water. Many of the region's bus stops also lack shelters or shade trees. So as extreme heat becomes more common, people may have to wait in the hot sun.
When you are taking transit, you're out in the elements more.